Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, weekday mornings at 6 a.m. on London DAB digital radio and on demand via the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com.
Joining us now to discuss is Sir Tony Brenton, who's a fellow at Wolfson College, Cambridge, and formerly the British ambassador to Russia. Sir Tony, welcome to Bloomberg Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, really lovely to have you. So look, the G20 communique calling the war in Ukraine a war seems a pretty low bar for this document.
Yeah, of course, the Russians have never called it a war. They've called it a special military operation. So the document, it's a very, what I've seen is actually rather expertly drafted to steer a delicate way around all sorts of people's obstacles. It doesn't directly criticise Russia. It criticises the war, but doesn't blame Russia for it. It implicitly criticizes Western sanctions. If you look at the economic bit of it, it's all about disruption of supply chains and hitting the global energy markets and so on, which war has something to do with it. But the real source of that disruption is, of course, Western sanctions. So it steers around various delicate points. I think the Indonesians have probably done a brilliant job. And with a bit of luck, they'll get it through. I mean, at the moment, it's agreed at the level of officials. It has to get through heads of government, and there's no guarantee of that. But it looks like a pretty craftsman-like job.
Now, you've met Vladimir Putin in the past. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how Russia will proceed in its offensive, in its war in Ukraine, given that it has suffered so many defeats recently, notably the retreat from Kherson.
Yeah. Putin, people have suggested that Putin is behaving irrationally. I have to say the retreat from Kherson suggests rather the reverse. And obviously, Russia has had a sequence of defeats now and is losing war. But the last two big ones in Kyiv and in Kharkiv were fiascos on the Russian military part. Kherson has been presented as, and this is reasonably and unusually honest of the Russians, as a strategic withdrawal from a place they could no longer hold on to. And what looks as if it's happening is that the Russians are hunkering down, drawing in their defensive lines to sit out the winter, strengthen their troops, hope that something else turns up diplomatically or however, and look for a better situation come the end of the winter lull. So on Putin himself, I mean, the Putin I knew was a gambler, but always calculated risks, the seizure of Crimea back in 2014 and so on. He calculated the odds and unusually, it has to be said, won. The invasion of Ukraine was completely out of character or completely out of the character of the Putin I knew. It was an uncalculated gamble and has obviously proven a disaster. Since then, however, he has been forced to do things which he didn't really want to do, but which Russia needed to do, the mobilization, which has been very painful, and now the surrender of Kherson, which has also been pretty painful, suggest that he's limiting his objectives, getting back to a more sensible approach to this war, and I'm pretty sure would be willing to negotiate if sensible bases for negotiation emerged.
Okay, well, what are sensible bases then? The Ukrainian President Zelensky appealed to the G19, as he called them, to press for peace now. I mean, surely the only peace deal possible would seem to run via Beijing?
Well, Beijing will help. I mean, Zelensky's terms set out the difficulties of our getting to a negotiation, really. Zelensky wants, first of all Ukrainian territory back, which includes Crimea. And I cannot state firmly enough how central Crimea is going to be in the end game, because if Putin is going to hang on to anything and do almost anything to hang on to it, it's Crimea. So first of all Ukrainian territory to be returned. Secondly, Russian war reparations. And thirdly, trials of Russian war criminals. Now, the Russians are simply not going to start from that basis. And there is some sign that the Americans in particular are trying to edge Ukraine into a more realistic approach to what being negotiable. Now, that's very politically difficult because obviously Zelensky has all the right on his side. His country has been invaded. There have been appalling atrocities committed on his territory and lots of destruction. But if there is to be a negotiated outcome, then something has to be done to narrow the gap between these Ukrainian demands and what Russia might be willing to accept.
How do you get the two sides to a negotiating table if you think there is a willingness or an opportunity to negotiate?
Well, it's not going to happen immediately. As I say, the Russians are hunkering down. The Ukrainians are on a roll. They hope they're going to continue the military successes after Kherson. So we'll have to see still, essentially, how the military situation evolves. What is also evolving, however, is almost visibly US discomfort with the thought that if the war gets to Crimea, which it's not that far away from now, then the Russians might turn irrational. And other major states, France, Germany, and so on, that they really want a negotiated outcome to this. What they don't want, what none of us really wants, is a sort of North Korea, Russia, angry, defeated, revanchist, stuck right beside Europe. We have to find an outcome which, yes, punishes Russia for the war, makes sure they don't do it again, but also leaves them in a situation to begin to mend relations with Europe. What we can't land ourselves with, if I can put it another way, is a Weimar Russia. A Russia the same as Germany after the First World War, where the peace process, the peace treaty that was imposed on them, simply gave us the Second World War.
Mm. We're speaking to Sir Tony Brenton, Fellow of Wharton College, Cambridge, also formerly the British Ambassador to Russia. Sir Tony, very interesting to get your views on the way forward when it comes to Ukraine. What do you think the current British Prime Minister's foreign policy is? Rishi Sunak's only a few weeks into the office, barely, although we know him as former Chancellor, obviously. Is Sunak simply a continuation of Boris Johnson's foreign policy? I mean, he gave the line that we all expected, that Russia should get out of Ukraine and end this barbaric war. But Britain has been quite important in terms of supplying weaponry.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there are only very odd hints that have emerged. And for the moment, Rishi Sunak has doubled down on the very hard line that we've been taking on Russia. We are, without doubt, the biggest hawk among major European states. And there's been no cost to that. We've actually been ahead of the game so far. I slightly worry that when it does come to peace negotiations, we're going to find ourselves left to one side because the Russians aren't interested in talking to us at all. But for the moment, the maintenance of our very hard line on Russia makes sense. What also makes sense is the hint that emerged, I think, from Sunak on his flight out to Bali yesterday, mm-hmm. that he may be reconsidering our attitude towards China. China also is a systemic challenge to us, but it's a lot further away, a lot less direct and illegal than Russia is. And for a country like the UK, which has not cut links, but broken off from its biggest trading partner, which was the EU, of course, which is looking around for new economic opportunities in the world, there's China, second biggest economy in the world, biggest trading nation in the world. Our attitude up until arrival of Sunak has been, they're as bad as Russia in many ways. You know, they're evil autocrats, all of that. Yesterday on the plane, there was an odd hint that we may look for a warmer economic relationship with China than certainly Boris Johnson or Liz Truss were working on.
Yes, but hang on. That is a change in language from the Prime Minister himself, isn't it? Because in terms of what I've read of the reporting of that conversation, it was Sunak using the phrase systemic challenge of China rather than systemic threat, which is something that he used in his campaigning over the summer to become PM.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well, there's a difference between campaigning. I mean, what do they say? Politicians campaign in poetry and govern in prose. You have to relearn the world once you're no longer trying to get into the seat. Sunak is now in the seat. He's spent, ever since he arrived as Prime Minister, his principal preoccupation, as you've copiously reported, has been with the economic mess that the UK is in. And quite an important part of the background to that is how we angle ourselves internationally in terms of trying to rebuild the links or build the links, which offer some substitute for the breaking off or diminution of links with the European Union. And there's China.
So, Tony, we are very focused on, given that you mentioned the economic issues, the autumn statement on Thursday, public services are going to face a cut. I'm wondering what sort of effect, should there be a cut to Foreign Office services, could have effect on Britain's foreign policy power if cutbacks have to be made?
Well, I think inevitably so. I mean, what diplomats, and I'm still enough of a diplomat to say this again, is that the Foreign Office costs less than one tank or some, you know, major piece of military equipment. It's actually a very cheap department to run. It's basically just people. And it does play quite an important part in spreading British influence. It has changed since I was there, of course, because it now incorporates the Development Ministry and there's much bigger money involved there and a much bigger direct threat to UK's overseas influence. We had a commitment to spend 0.7% of our GDP on foreign aid. That's already been cut back to 0.5% because of the economic problems we're facing. And it's becoming clear that a growing proportion of that 0.5% is actually not being spent overseas at all, but is being spent domestically on housing immigrants who are getting across the channel. Now, the less money we have to spend internationally is going to diminish our international standing, obviously, in various ways. Now, that's a price which we are paying. We're having to cut our coat according to our cloth, sadly. And it underlines the lesson, which I'm sure is at the top and front of Sunak's mind, which is we need to get the economy moving again.
Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, weekday mornings at 6 a.m. on London DAB digital radio and on demand via the Bloomberg Business app and BloombergRadio.com.